Hi, just welcome to today's sutta class. I forget who it was, but somebody actually asked me to go through this sutta. It's number 44. It's called Chula Wedala Sutta. It's a tough sutta to go through. It's very, very refined. But it does bring out a few points, interesting points, especially technical points for those who have quite a thorough understanding of the Buddhism, especially of the suttas and the Dhamma. So this is 44, Chula Wedala Sutta, shorter series of questions and answers. I forget actually who asked for this one, but it was in my mind that this is one of the suttas for today. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Tamang Sangkang Namasami. So this is sutta number 44. If you haven't got your book, there's sheets of paper on the table there with sutta number 44 written on it, the Chula Wedala Sutta. And again, it is a quite refined sutta with somebody asking questions of somebody else on some very fine points of the Dhamma. And we'll explain it as we go along. And the other interesting thing, that this is one of the suttas where the teaching is coming from a bhikkhuni, a nun. So it just shows you just how the bhikkhunis were well respected in the time of the Buddha. This is one of the suttas from a bhikkhuni, from a nun. Thus I have heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Then the lay follower Visakha went to the bhikkhuni, Dhammadina, and after paying homage to her, he sat down at one side and asked her the following questions. And the commentary says, it's in the notes in the back, that Visakha, this is not Visakha, the female lay disciple, this is a guy, a man, Visakha. And Dhammadina was his former wife. So they'd both got interested in Dhamma, and she was the one who ordained. And she became an arahat, and her ex-husband, he became a non-returner. So certainly these were very highly attained people. And I'm not quite sure why Visakha was asking these questions, because if that was Visakha's attainment, he would know the answer to these questions. But I think he was asking these questions just to check how his wife was doing. And she obviously gave all the right answers. And because of that, it was such a beautiful set of answers that it became one of the suttas. So here we go. First question, lady. Personality is said. What is called personality by the Blessed One? Now this is a special word. It's Sakaya. Many of you may know that because Sakaya Ditti, the personality view, is the first and main fetter which is overcome by the stream winner, by the Sotapanna. So the first stage of enlightenment is when you actually overcome this Sakaya Ditti. And it was mentioned a little bit later on, personality view, on the next page, 397. Personality view is Sakaya Ditti. This is the Sakaya. What does it mean, Sakaya? Literally, it means, you know, what's with a body. Body plus, basically, it means. So really what it means, body and mind, body and mind. And so what is this body and mind anyway? And this is a classic way in Buddhism of having a framework to describe this Sakaya, which many people take to be you. Basically, it's asking the question, who are you? And friend. Lady, friend, Visakha. They don't, you know, call a husband darling anymore. So, you know, when you're married, yes, dear, and snuggles or whatever else you call each other. But once you're ordained, you call your friend. So, friend, Visakha. These five aggregates affected by clinging, the five khandhas, are called a person. I like to call it person rather than personality. Something to do with, you know, what you take yourself to be. Personality by the Blessed One. Because it's not the same word as personality in English. In personality in English, you know, you have a happy personality or a sort of a jovial personality or a sort of miserable personality. So it's not personality in that way. It's another word. It means this thing, you know, which you call a self. That's what it, if you get your head around that, you know, what you sort of you take yourself to be. This is what Sakaya means. Again, literally means that which is with your body plus. Is that clear? Okay. So I'm going to call it body plus. So, friend, Visakha, the five aggregates affected by clinging are called body plus by the Blessed One. That is, the material form aggregate affected by clinging, your body. The feeling aggregate affected by clinging, which will come later on to explain, it's the pleasure and pain or the in-between state associated with every one of the senses. That's called a thing called feeling. Perception, which is exactly the same, pretty much as the English word for perception. The perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations, the mental formations affected by clinging. And this is many, many things in the mental formations, things like thoughts, things like emotions. But most importantly, the most central feature of the mental formations is chetana, or will. So will fits in that fourth aggregate. And lastly, consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. These five aggregates affected by clinging are called body plus, the person by the Blessed One. Saying, good lady, the lay follower is Visakha, delighted and rejoiced in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words. Then he asked her a further question. The origin of personality. This is the origin of this body and mind. He said, what does he call the origin of body plus by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is craving. This is dhanha, which brings renewal of being, which is the same word for rebirth. It's accompanied by delight and lust, delights in this and that, that is, the craving for sensual pleasures, that's the pleasures of the five senses, or, as Ajahn Bhamani pointed out, I mentioned this on the retreat, it can also mean, and more likely to mean, the craving just for the five senses themselves, let alone just the pleasures. Craving for being or for existence and a craving for non-being. This is called the origin of body plus, body and mind, by the Blessed One. Now, hopefully, some of you here would have noticed that this is the same explanation of the Second Noble Truth. Second Noble Truth always says, what is the origin of suffering? It is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, delights in this and that. That is, craving for the sensual pleasures, craving for being, craving for non-being. Exactly the same as the cause of suffering. So straight away, you see, and you can see the next one, is the cessation of, here, so personality, cessation of suffering. The way leading to the cessation of personality, the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So you see here, instead of actually asking the Four Noble Truths from the cause of, like, suffering, he's saying is from the cause of you. What are you? Why are you? Sort of how does this all stop? And what's the power to make it stop? So it's the Four Noble Truths looking at the person, the five aggregates, that which you take yourself to be, instead of suffering as the focus of the Four Truths. That comes clear in number three and number four. Yes. That's. Okay. The delusion is more fundamental. So this is more like the proximate cause. For especially renewal of being, for the creation of this body and mind. So delusion is there, but it's also craving. Remember during the retreat which you attended, I say the more you crave, especially the more you will, the stronger your sense of self becomes. So your craving is creating that sense of self, that person. Which is why people who use a lot of will have a very strong sense of self and ego. The people who let go a lot, which is just kind and gentle, just don't really will very much, their ego sort of disappears. This is what we recognize in people. They haven't got a strong ego. They don't have many wants and desires. They don't want to control everybody. And that's a sign that with the lessening of craving, your personality disappears, which is the next paragraph. Yes, Jacob? Indeed, craving for non-being is another control freak type of thing. So you just create a greater sense of self. The craving for non-being, the best example of that, you want to cease, you want to get rid of yourself, but you come back even stronger afterwards. Now, this great simile is from Oliver Twist, Charles Dickens' book, where one of the characters there, he would always make this threat. If that happens, then I'll eat my own head. And there's a wonderful little saying, to eat one's own head, because it makes everybody contemplate, how can that be done? And of course, it's impossible to eat your own head, because you need a head to eat something. So it's an impossible thing to do. You can say it, but it cannot be done. So the craving to not be sounds possible. It's very much like eating your own head. I am wanting to stop. And it's like the ego trying to eat itself. The craving not to be. That's why it's a craving. But let's go back to those three cravings, because it's part of the second. It is the second noble truth. But here we're going to, instead of suffering, to these five khandhas, to a person, to a being, showing that these khandhas, they are suffering. And the whole idea of this is ending these khandhas, ending another body, also ending all feeling, all pleasure and pain, all perception, all will, and even all consciousness. Now that's a very powerful statement by the Buddha, because most people, they want to they end suffering, but they want to be conscious afterwards so they can enjoy all their hard work. So they want to go to Nibbana and be there to enjoy it afterwards. But it's very clear, cannot do. But anyway, let's go to those cravings again. It doesn't come out, I mentioned it in passing, doesn't really come out in the translation here. The three types of craving, for sensual pleasures, craving for being and craving for non-being, the sensual pleasures one is only regarding any pleasure of the five senses. This again is mentioned further down in the sutta. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. It does not apply to the pleasures of the mind. So the way in Pali, senses is always five senses. The sixth sense, the mind, is always regarded separately from these five. So craving for the pleasures of the mind are specifically excluded. That comes a bit clearer later on. So please remember that the pleasure of the mind, things like just inspiration, hearing a great teaching or seeing someone do an amazing act of kindness. The inspiration of your own generosity, of your own lifestyle. Inspiration of going to see Jhanagraha, seeing this great center there, which is available for everybody. It's a wonderful place to stay. Or the joy which comes up in your own mind, when you get very peaceful and very still. All those joys, they're mental joys. Nothing to do with their five senses. And those sorts of things are to be encouraged and followed. They're not the danger. That's not the craving which leads to rebirth. You're thinking, yes. Ainsley, yeah. Yeah. Very much so. And it's the pleasures of the senses, the Buddha always said, the dangerous ones. No. Because it's the pleasures of the mind, the real pleasures of the mind, are the pleasures born of letting go of these things. The pleasures of freedom, the pleasures of peace. So it's an important point, because many of you, when you meditate, you'll start getting happy. I don't know how many people on a meditation retreat come up to me the first time and said, I was getting lots of peace and happiness. This can't be right. What do you mean it can't be right? Well, aren't you supposed to suffer to get enlightenment? No pain, no gain. It's supposed to be a meditation retreat. I'm supposed to learn something. Yeah, you learn about happiness. You already know enough about pain. Just going to get married or get... Sorry about that. It's a monk's joke. Just get old, go to work, whatever. But you don't know about suffering enough. You've had enough suffering in their life. But it's actually getting to know that happiness. And it's amazing how many people are afraid of that happiness. They think it can't be right. And the Buddha is actually saying, yeah, that is right. That's the path. So, especially when you get strong happiness, bliss states, people are very afraid of that. It can't be right. It is right. So that's what the craving for the sense pleasures, the craving for being. Now, I've noticed that come very strong, especially when you're with somebody at the last moments of their life. Have you ever been someone who's dying, just being with them? And sometimes they're hurting. And they know there's no way that pain or that discomfort is going to sort of ever be removed except through death. But will they die? No. Even though they know the pain is going to be there, the sensory pleasure is nowhere near as strong as the craving to be, to exist. And if they don't understand about rebirth, they think that when they die, that's it, they're going to go. They're going to struggle to the very end. Don't matter how much it hurts. I'd rather hurt and be than not hurt and not be. So the craving to exist, to be, is very, very strong. You see that when people die. Now, the other time you see it, and it's an interesting one when you get into deep meditation, as you get into deep meditation, parts of you disappear. Now, your body disappears, and sometimes people don't like that. Why? Because that's who they think they are. It's like they're vanishing. They don't want to vanish. And then when other parts of them start vanishing, like their will vanishes, ooh, that's really scary. Even though it's suffering, they'd rather be and be able to do things rather than just disappear and vanish. And when your mind starts to vanish, that's really scary. And a lot of time we stop the whole process because we are vanishing and we just don't like that. We want to be. So that's what the craving for being, which you can see, stops you letting go. And that's mentioned just the craving for not being. You have enough understanding, you've had enough of this rebirth, so you want to stop it. But if you want to stop it, you can't do it. So say if you try and stop thinking. You meditation retreats, try and stop thinking, it cannot be done. You have to let go of thinking, not stopping it. Or what I was saying on the retreat, let go of that thing inside which is trying to stop things, which is trying to create things, which is starting to move the meditation this way or that way. You're letting go of the wrong thing. Thoughts. You're letting go of thoughts. You should be letting go of the controller which creates those thoughts. If you let go of that thing inside, the controller, the doer, then all that stuff outside stops. So you're letting go of the wrong thing. When you're letting go of the wrong thing, that's called the craving for non-being. You should be letting go of the craving, not the non-being or the being. Letting go of what's inside rather than what's outside. So let's just go on, just to finish this whole little section. That's number two. So what's the origin of this personality, this being which you call yourself? And what is the cessation of this being, this five khandhas? And again, just saying that, can these five khandhas actually cease? Can consciousness actually end? In other words, the end of rebirth, the end of will. Obviously it can. What is the cessation of these five khandhas? Cessation of body, the cessation of feeling, the cessation of perception, the cessation of will, thinking, the cessation of consciousness. It is the remainderless, fading away in cessation, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. So it's not letting go of what's out there, it's letting go of the craving. That is called the cessation of this body plus by the Blessed One. And for those of you who are on Friday, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting, those are the four ways of letting go, which the giving up is the no expectations, giving, expecting nothing in return, relinquishes, throwing things away, when I got the stick and throwed it away. The letting go that got here, that's the freedom, that's the being content to be here. And rejecting is the Teflon mind, which rejects anything, nothing sticks to it. So that was actually the talk last night which I gave, also on Friday night, the four ways of letting go. That is precisely the meaning of those four terms, giving up, relinquishing, letting go, rejecting. Those are English translations, not the best, but those are the four words I explained on Friday night. How to let go of craving. So remember, in meditation, in Buddhism, we're not going to let go of our house, of our car, of our money, of your wife, of your kids. You let go of the craving. Let go of the controlling. And then many other things disappear anyway. But you're letting go of in here, not what's out there. Which is why that people just don't understand, don't get it, what this letting go is. They let go of the wrong thing. Some people, who was it? It was, I think, Tina Turner, when she was a Buddhist, and people said, why are you a Buddhist? Oh, because as a Buddhist, I can do whatever I want. What? Well, it's all about letting go. Letting go of precepts, not attaching to anything. Or like Rajneesh used to say, he said, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. It's a great line, but really a scallywag line. So really detached, you're not even attached to precepts, so just do whatever you want. So that's letting go of the wrong thing. Letting go of the craving inside is where it comes from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a further separate, but the old story is a classic story. One of the people who used to come here, I think he still comes here, he took the five precepts for the first time. He was really inspired. You know, you want to keep all these precepts. You know, the fifth precept, no alcohol. So the next time he went to work, to some sort of reception, when you know, they gave him some alcohol to drink, and he said, no, sorry, I'm a Buddhist, I don't drink alcohol anymore. And the guy serving it was some smart aleck. He said, oh, Buddhist, we know about Buddhists. It's all about letting go, isn't it? It's letting go. He said, yeah, that's right. Come on, let go. Have some alcohol. And you see, his idea of letting go was letting go of all your restraint and just relaxing. He was letting go of the wrong thing. And a lot of times people think that way. Just let go. Just enjoy. Have sex. Come on, let go of just all these ideas. You have to have sex with your husband, or you don't have to have another relationship with somebody else. And some people think that way. That letting go is letting go of all the rules and restrictions and just being free. But you know, I said that alone. Somewhere, freedom, that's right, last Friday night. That's a freedom of desire rather than freedom from desire. So let go of the right thing, especially in meditation. Let go of the thing doing the controlling. When you get that idea of what you're supposed to let go of, the meditation just flows. Yeah.
If my understanding of what you're saying is correct, it seems to mean, because of what I'm interpreting, that this letting go process needs a lot of energy and courage.
Courage, for sure.
In the sense that keeping the precept is a form of letting go.
Yes. Yeah, it's letting go of the thing which causes suffering. So it's not a hard thing to do, because it gives you so much happiness and peace and meaning. So you're letting go, as I said, a thing on Friday night, like stones in your backpack. You say, well, what do I want to keep this for? Waste of time. So it makes you feel more free. So it is a courageous thing to do. It's the same courage. There's something I mentioned of a prisoner who's been in prison for about 20, 30 years, and now they've got their freedom. Often they don't want to walk out the door. They got used to the institution. They're comfortable, they know how it works. Now they've got to walk out, and it's scary. So it's that sort of the courage to face the unknown, what it's like without those attachments. What will happen when you don't have any craving or desire? I saw somebody doing the meditation retreat. It is sometimes in meditation, it is very much like you're driving along the freeway, taking Ajahn Brahm back to Bodhnyana Monastery, going 110 kilometers an hour. And I turn around to you and say, take your hand off the steering wheel, take your feet off the pedal. Say, I'll crash! No, you won't. Take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. It takes a lot of courage to do that. That's only a simile. Don't do that on the freeway. But in meditation, do it. and see what happens. You think, this can't work, but it does. So yeah, it is courageous to do that.
In terms of especially, I mean, as far as I see from my practice, it seems that the courage to face the cold turkey process.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not actually the initial stage, it's very happy. As soon as you let it go, you feel terribly free. Wow, it's so easy. And you get the sort of the idea, this is how it works. You like let go of the things outside, it never works. I used to give another simile. You know a hand? What it does is pick things up. My hand's always doing that. So I say, come on, let go, stop picking up. Stop it. Stop it. It always picks things up, my hand. That's what it does. So how can I stop my hand attaching and grasping things? There's only one way. Cut it off. When you cut the hand off, then it doesn't pick up anything. You cut off the craving, and then it doesn't attach to things. If you try and let go, let go, let go, let go, let go, let go, of things out there without cutting off the craving, the hand, which does the grasping, it never works. And that was like the early life as a monk. But you're a monk, you're not supposed to crave and have many things. So you gave up girls and sex. You look at a young monk, so you crave for food. So I gave up one thing, I was craving another thing. And that was always the life, you know, you put down one thing and then you crave for something else. You give up one thing, you give up TV, and then you crave for music. You give up music and you crave for, you know, something else. And there's always picking things up. And always putting them down and picking something else up afterwards. It was endless. Until you realize, what do you expect? That's what a hand does, it picks things up. So I had to cut off the craving. When you cut off the craving, then it doesn't pick things up anymore. So that's a letting go. So once you let go of this craving business, attachments just pretty much cease. You can have friends, but you don't worry about them. Go to work, it doesn't matter, it's just something you do. But it's not a big thing anymore. You're not picking things up anymore. Okay, let's go to the fourth one, otherwise we'll be here until next week. The way leading to cessation of body plus personality, the way leading to cessation of personality is said, you know, how this five khandhas stops. What is called the way leading to cessation of personality by the Blessed One? Surprise, surprise, Fenvisaka, it is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, right concentration. Stillness is I prefer than concentration, so from now on I'm going to call it right stillness. Exactly as in the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. So it's exactly the same as the Four Noble Truths, except taking suffering and putting in the five khandhas, you, basically. Making the point that you are suffering. As long as there's a sense of self, a sense of me, a sense of a person, you're going to suffer. Fenvisaka, the end bit here, that clinging, so the five aggregates, except, that's number six. Lady, is that clinging the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging, or is the clinging something apart from those five aggregates affected by clinging? Visaka, that clinging is neither the same nor different than the five aggregates affected by clinging. It is the desire and lust, you know, in regard to these five aggregates, you know, which comes from them, from the five aggregates, and actually wants more of those five aggregates. The desire for even to be conscious, the desire to sort of have this not thought rather than that thought, especially the desire for pleasure and the antipathy towards unpleasant feelings, even the desire for a body and clinging, that's the clinging. So they're saying the clinging is emanating from your old five khandhas and is actually wants to create new five khandhas. So it's not the same, not different. Five aggregates affected by clinging. So that's already incredibly sort of powerful, deep suttas. But remember, this is a non-returner talking to an arahat. So these are really highly attained people. Now this one is the next personality view. This is Sakkaya Ditti, the first of the 10 fetters which stop you being enlightened, especially the first of the 3 fetters which stop you being a stream winner. So all of you who want to be sotapannas, The word in Sinhalese is Sowan. And just any Buddhist who comes here from Sri Lanka, they always say, yeah, I want to be Sowan, I want to be Sowan, I want to be Sowan. This is the obstacle, Sakkaya Ditti. And it's great to know exactly what that Sakkaya Ditti is, according to Buddhism. And it's quite amazing that even some Thai monks I know, because they, you know, they just follow their teacher rather than reading what the Buddha said, they say Sakkaya with a body, it means you believe the body to be a self. As long as you realize the body is not you, but something in the mind may still be you. So that's being a stream winner, which is absolutely ridiculous. This is what Sakkaya Ditti means. Personality view. Here, friend Visakha, untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones, is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma, who has no regard for true men, and is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma. That's just gloss for someone who hasn't seen the Dhamma yet. Regards material form, that's your body, as a self, or as self-possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or as self as in material form. Same with all the other four of the five khandhas. Feeling, perception, mental formations, including will, and consciousness. He regards consciousness as the self. This is me. This is what I am. I am the will, or I am the consciousness. I am the feeling. Or as the self is possessed of these things. This is what the self owns. This is, you know, its possessions. So a self is that which knows. A self is that which can do, which can think. A self is that which can perceive. A self is that which can feel pleasure and pain. This is me. I am the one who owns my will, who owns my consciousness. That too is a personality view. Or a self as somehow contained in these things. So you have all these five khandhas, and it's an essence. Instead of just ordinary consciousness, like a pure essential consciousness, like a pure, wise, pure will, like a pure feeling, such as just pleasure or bliss, that's the real me, the happiness, and all this painful stuff. And I wasn't feeling myself that day, that wasn't the real me. So as somehow that these khandhas contain a self, or as self as, sorry, in these formations. So either the self contains these things, or that's contained within these five khandhas. And it's basically the Buddha is pointing out that you can't actually, there's no place left to actually to posit a self, a soul. It's not the same as, it doesn't own these things, it's not contained in, or it's not bigger than the five khandhas. Sometimes people actually say, the real self, the real soul, yeah, it's sort of beyond the five khandhas, and the soul sort of somehow contains the five khandhas. And you see, that's the self as in the five khandhas. That's that's right, self as in the five khandhas. That's number three. No, sorry. No, self as in consciousness. That's number four, the last one. So basically, there's no way you can actually posit a self outside of the five khandhas, inside the five khandhas, or anything to do with the five khandhas. So anyone who says that, yeah, when the five khandhas cease, that somehow there's something left, then that's the real you. This teaching totally abolishes such a possibility. So any idea of an original mind outside of the five khandhas, if that was the case, that would be, the Buddha would not have included this case, which is number four, in this total denunciation of any type of self to do with the five khandhas. Within, without, possessed of, anything to do, or the same as. Very powerful. Very clear. And anyone who does believe in that, that there is, the self is the same as one or all the five khandhas, or the self is possesses the five khandhas, or the self is within the five khandhas, or the self is outside the five khandhas, but possesses, but no, the five khandhas is in the self. Anyone who thinks like that, that's called Sakkaya Ditti. They cannot be stream winner. powerful. So how does personality view not come to be? This is number 8. Here, friend Visakha, a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, who has regard for true people and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, this is means they've seen the Dhamma. They do not regard any of these 5 khandhas, material form, feeling, perception, mental formations including will or consciousness. They don't regard any of these things as a self. They don't regard the self as possessed of any of these things, or that these things are somehow included in this great big self, or there's a self contained within this these things. It's like a part, a pure part of something gross. That is how personality view does not come to be. And is that clear? Because that's a very powerful statement, and it's controversial because some very senior monks say otherwise. Yeah? That's right, yeah.
And in my belief, my first exposure to religion is so-called Christianity. I can't see those Mahayana, I don't want to use the word Mahayana, but all this kind of Buddhism that is not based on this stream meaning.
Yeah.
To me, it's basically not Buddhism then.
Well, this is, I'll let you sort of form your own conclusions on that. But on this one, I'm just saying exactly, well, this is actually not what the Buddha said, but later on he sort of confirms this is exactly what I would say. This comes from the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. Brilliant teacher, straight down the line. This is actually repeated elsewhere by the Buddha, especially in Sangyutta Nikaya, the Khanda Sangyutta. So this is here, just recited by Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, Dhammadina, sorry. But in the Sangyutta Nikaya, it's actually straight out of the mouth of a Buddha. This is how we have the idea of a self. Either one of these 5 khandhas, all the 5 khandhas together, this is me. Or somehow I own these things. I own my mind, I own my will, I own my pleasure and pain. Or that somehow you are contained within these, body and mind. Somewhere in there there's like this wispy soul. You know, not in your body, but maybe in your mind somewhere. Or your mind, a bigger thing, contains these things. The 4 ways. And the Buddha just goes to each one of them, saying, no, 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 no. No, 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 no. Sorry, I did one too many no's. That's very clear. Conscience, it is just
an effect of a previous cause.
Indeed, but it's something which I've often mentioned to you that I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, that Buddhism doesn't have guilt. You don't have like punishment in the Vinaya. You don't mean bad monk, 50 strokes of the cat. Except for, you know, the real 50 strokes of the cat, find a cat and strike it 50 times and earn some compassion. There's no real punishment. And even the idea of guilt or remorse is something that you let go of the past. And you find if you really let go of the past and you do forgive, you let go of guilt, you let go of anger, that overcomes the cause of future misconduct. So people think, if you don't punish, the person will do it again, and it may even get worse. And you forgive and let it go, you're just giving them open slather just to misbehave even worse next time. And the opposite is true. If you forgive and let go of the past, you don't misbehave again. You don't repeat. And you know that I've personal experience of that all the times I've taught in prison. And that story of this prison officer who called me and said, in the prison service for so many years, most of my life, and one thing I noticed about you, Ajahn Brahm, all the prisoners who came to your class never go back to jail again. I'd hit something very clearly inside of them, forgiveness. So the reason for reoffending was not there when they were released. And that was actually quite remarkable, because the recidivism rate is quite high. Somehow you stop that. And I And I sort of say that's because I taught those prisoners to forgive themselves, to let go of their past, totally. So the conscience is only in the present moment. I'm doing a stupid thing, I'm not going to do that. But it doesn't go back, oh, I did a terrible thing today. Oh, I said the wrong thing to Barbara, I shouldn't have said that. You let it go. It's a powerful teaching, it's beautiful. You let go of the past, good and bad. And it's also the case, this is, you've heard me say this before, but not many other monks say this. Why is it when you do become a stream winner, when you don't regard a soul as the same as any of these khandhas, or possessing them, or within them, or containing them, why is it they say here that a stream winner is no longer subject to being reborn in the lower realms as a punishment? No, well, nobody to be reborn, but really no one to be punished. You've let go of that idea of punishment. So you just will not send yourself to a lower realm. And the only reason people get reborn in hell, and there is a hell, and you create your own hell, your hell, there's never been a hell like the one you will send yourself to if you go down there. You'll create it your own way. I remember just being in Penang over Christmas, and on Christmas day, I think the evening, after teaching meditation all day, about 10 o'clock, you go and try and have a sleep. And being Christmas Day, they had a party just opposite from the temple. You could actually see everyone there, karaoke. And my goodness, I'm sure that some people can sing, but these people, they just couldn't sing for their lives. But they wanted to, and they did it really loud. They must have had lots of alcohol. And for me, that would be hell. If I went to hell, it would be when people sing karaoke all day and all night. The thing is, you create your hell. And that's, you know, what you think you need to be punished. And when you become a stream winner, you realize, I don't need to be punished anymore. I can forgive myself. I don't need a Jesus to forgive me. I don't need to go in front of a Buddha or a monk to forgive me. I don't need to ask the person I hurt to forgive me. I forgive me. And that is the most powerful. Other people, they may say, I forgive you, I don't forgive you. But the most crucial one is, I forgive me. And you can do that. And not only you can do it, it's what you're supposed to do. You're encouraged to do that. And now have no fear, you become a much better person afterwards. Yeah.
Because they still cherish the self, they need appreciation, they need a self acknowledgement by others. Because of this thing blocking the way.
Yeah, but that is really just a temporary forgiving. You ask someone else, you go in front of a Buddha statue. Yeah, it sort of works temporarily, superficially, but the one, you have to do it. You have to say, I really forgive what I've done. I'm going to let it go. I'm not going to punish me any longer. I can say that. But people don't believe it. They've got to do it themselves. It's you who have to say, the door of my heart's open to me. Totally, no matter what I've ever done. I can show you the words, but you have to walk along that journey. That's a need which is, what they need is to be free from that pain. But then, using that as a way, it might give them a superficial temporary sense of relief, but not the total one. It might, or the best it can do is encourage you to make that step for yourself. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm's forgiven me, my husband's forgiven me, Jesus has forgiven me, or whatever else you believe has forgiven me. That just encourages you to make the most important step. Well, if all those people forgive me, then I forgive me. That is the crucial step. No one else can do it for you. Buddhas can only show the way. We have to walk that way. Then you're free. And that's why a person who knows that there's no self in there is so easy to forgive. And therefore you'd never send yourself to the lower realms anymore. A neat thing to do. The Eightfold Path. Lady, what is the Noble Eightfold Path? Friend Visakha, it is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, intention, right speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and right stillness. Lady, is the Noble Eightfold Path conditioned or unconditioned? Now, an unconditioned is like nirvana, just no causes, it's just, can't really describe it, an unconditioned. Now, of course, when some Buddha starts talking about conditioned and unconditioned, that opens slather for all sorts of weird ideas of what's conditioned and what's unconditioned. So much so that you get something like bare perception. It's bare perception. Before you start thinking, or even labeling, is that conditioned or unconditioned? Totally conditioned. Because by the time it's recognized in your mind by perception, you've already filtered and selected what you want to see. Ask any psychologist. They will tell you all the incredible, powerful evidence of how our very perception, even before we start thinking, has been bent to suit us. And I've given examples, given talks about that before. So, yeah, even this Eightfold Path is conditioned. So, the Noble Eightfold Path is conditioned. Lady, are the three aggregates included by the Eightfold Path? This is the three Sila Samadhi Panya, virtue, stillness, and wisdom. Sometimes they say virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Sila Samadhi Panya, the triple practice it's called. It's a very common word in Buddhism. Are these triple practice included by the Noble Eightfold Path, or is the Noble Eightfold Path included by the three Sila Samadhi Panya? The three aggregates are not included by the Noble Eightfold Path when recyclable. The Noble Eightfold Path is included by the three aggregates. So in other words, the Sila Samadhi Panya contains the Eightfold Path. So has I got it the right way around? That's right. The three aggregates contain the Eightfold Path. So you've got right speech, right action, right livelihood. That's the aggregate of virtue. That's what we mean by virtue. So the virtue contains those three factors. Right effort, mindfulness, and right stillness. These are included in the aggregate of stillness of meditation. right view and right intention are included in the wisdom. Now I'm going to make a little bit out of this because effort, mindfulness, and stillness are included in the aggregate of stillness. So I mentioned a lot when I teach meditation, it's the effort to stop. It's a stillness. It's contained in stillness. So it's not an effort which does things and creates more agitation. It's an effort to stop. It's the effort to put the brakes on, to turn off the gas, to turn off the light switch. It's an effort to stop, not to create more. That's why one of Ajahn Chah's famous teachings, we meditate not to attain more things, but to let go of things, to stop, an effort to let go. Not an effort to get some more things. So if you try to get jhana, no way. Or as I said in the retreat, you've heard me say this before, I can't meditate. I can't attain jhanas. I can't attain jhanas. I have to disappear. I have to stop trying. And then these things come by themselves. I can't attain them. I disappear. And then they come. Understand? That type of no effort. And right view and right intention. These are included in the aggregate of wisdom. Now the intention, it has to come from wisdom. The three right intentions. This is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. What are those three right intentions? All those of you on the retreat at Jhana Grove, make peace, be kind, be gentle. You must be sick of that by now. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Those are the three right intentions. So you need to be wise to understand those. Yes. It's almost like movement of mind. Sometimes it's called plan, sometimes it's called thought. It's really laying out a plan. So it's, you know, where your intention's coming from. Could also be like a motive, like motivation. The motivation, making peace, kind, gentleness. It's just the way you move and think, rather than what you're doing. Doesn't really matter what you're being aware of in meditation. It's how you're being aware.
I don't know if
Sorry? Attitude can be good. Right attitude. Sometimes it's been, that's a translation which has been used many times before. Yes, Bronwyn? Where are we number two? We're in Noble Eightfold Path. That's the end of the bottom of page 301. Don't be afraid, because in this class you don't get sent into the corner and punished. Very good. Of course you're not here. We just told you you're not here. Yeah, you're probably the best student of all. Okay, where are we going now? Are we at the bottom of page 398? The next series of questions is on stillness or concentration. Lady, the ex-husband is saying to this great Arahat Bhikkhuni, what is samadhi, stillness? What is the basis of stillness? It's interesting here, this is what is the nimitta of stillness. Nimitta used in another way. Nimitta is used in many ways. For example, just whenever we create a consecrated boundary around a sort of an ordination area, we put stones, and they are the signs, they're the nimittas. And that's a use in the Vinaya, we have this. So again, the nimitta is like a sign. We use it in the practice of stillness and jhana as a sign of the mind. That's why it's called nimitta. It's a sign of the mind, a light. Sometimes a feeling, but again, you know that I prefer using the lights. It's a sign the mind is there. So it's a sign. So what is the sign of concentration? What is the equipment of concentration? Equipment is like the support. This word parikara, we learn that my support is my rose, my bowl, my bag, my slippers. These are the things which support my life as a monk. So what actually supports the equipment of concentration? The same way a soldier would get his equipment so he can go into battle, whatever he needs to do. What is the requisites, the equipment? And what is the development of stillness? Unification of mind, Fenwisaka, is stillness or samadhi. Of course, unification, a oneness of mind. It doesn't mean oneness for a moment. Everyone has a singleness of mind right now. You're on one thing and then another thing and then another thing. But right now, in this present moment, you're on one thing. But that's not what oneness of mind means, because that's ordinary. It means a oneness which lasts for a long time. A sustained oneness. A unification of mind through time. Stillness. So nothing changes or moves. That's what we mean by stillness. That's why I prefer stillness and concentration. Sometimes when you have concentration, it's almost like spatial. A unification, people think spatial. It's like I'm just writing a tiny little point, maybe on the tip of my nose. That's oneness of mind. If it goes backwards and forwards, that's not oneness. It's it stays in one point. Not in the body, but in the mind. Stillness of mind. That's what it means. The four foundations of mindfulness are the basis of concentration, the sign of stillness. In other words, when you are still, you'll be able to be mindful of these four focuses of mindfulness, I prefer, of form, of feeling, of consciousness or citta, mind, and objects, mind objects. So it's only when there's stillness there that you can really truly be mindful of these things. If you're all over the place, you're not really knowing anything much. The simile which I gave on the retreat gave many times, the road up to Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. When I was going in a car, looking through the window, I never really saw what was going on that hillside. But when I got out and walked, I saw much more. When I was absolutely still, I saw the whole hillside. And it was amazing. I never recognized where I was. 7 years or so, looking through the window of a car at the road where I lived. And now when I stopped, I could see it for the first time. If you haven't done that yet, try it. Sort of walk down the road where you live, rather than always sort of going in your car. And you will see things you've never seen before. And you may be living in that house for I don't know how many years. Have you actually walked up the road? Have you stopped and looked? You see so much more. Why? Because only when there's stillness can you really see things. So when you have stillness, you see things. That's almost like the sign that samadhi is there, that you've got real mindfulness. So the sign of stillness is mindfulness. People were asking me, just, how do you know your meditation is going well? How do you know you're getting peaceful and still? And that's where I gave the simile of the three people, the two couple and their dog, Vipassana, Samatha, and Metta the dog. You've all heard that one before, I hope, haven't you? The three. No, there's this couple, Sam and Vi. Samatha and Vipassana. Samatha Vipassana. You know, this peace and Vipassana, insight meditation, and calm meditation. So Samatha and Vipassana decided to go walk up Meditation Mountain one afternoon after lunch. They decided to take their dog with them, and their dog was called Metta, Metta little dog. And Samatha, he went up Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful up there. So his idea of walking up Meditation Mountain was for the peace and the calm and the stillness. And Vipassana, she went up Meditation Mountain because there was a great view up top there. So she went up there for the view. And Metta the dog, she went up there just because of the fun. She has great fun. She loves going up Meditation Mountain. And so as Sam got higher and higher, it got more and more peaceful. Oh, it's just lovely up there. And as Vipassana got higher and higher up the hill, she could see further. The view became so great. And as Metta the dog, the higher she got up Meditation Mountain, the more she wagged her tail. It's happier and happier. When they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, oh, Samatha, it was so still. A peace beyond understanding. And Vipassana, she could see for miles in all directions on top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog, oh, she was wagging her tail so much, it was like it's falling off. You know, you see the dogs wagging their tail so much and running around in circles, they're so blissed out. That's what Metta the dog was doing. But Sam, he could enjoy the peace. But he had eyes, he also enjoyed the view, and he was so happy up there. Vi, his wife, yeah, she enjoyed the view, but she could also feel the peace, she was also happy. And of course, Metta the dog, so happy, so peaceful. Even dogs have eyes, they can see the view too. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, peace, insight, and happiness coexist. You can't separate them. So, how do you understand you're making progress? Peace is very hard to pin down sometimes, how peaceful you are. Insight is even worse as a judge of how you're going. Because some people have all these insights, and they're absolutely crazy, they're deceiving themselves. Happiness, sir, that's very easy to understand. So that's why I say the best sign that you're making progress in meditation is how you, as little Metta the dog, are wagging your tail. How happy you are. How much inner joy you have. How much real love you have. That's the best sign. So, the sign of here, the sign of stillness here, they say is your mindfulness, your clarity. They're using my insight. How clear it is. The higher you go and meditate, you may be still, but it's how far you can see is a sign of your stillness. And what is the equipment of stillness? You know, what supports it? The four right kinds of striving, the right effort are the equipment of concentration. Wow, stillness. And those are the striving to get rid of unwholesome states which have gone in the mind, to keep them out in the first place, to arouse wholesome states and to maintain those wholesome states. It doesn't actually say trying, it's just whatever is needed to get beautiful states of mind. And the way you get beautiful states of mind is by letting go. And the development of concentration or stillness is keeping on doing it again and again and again and again and again. So there's nothing betters, just repeated practice till you get the hang of it. So if you haven't got the hang of it yet, you've got to come to another meditation retreat and another one and another one and another one till you get the hang of it. Repetition, development. Woo! Yeah. It's going to be a late day. Okay, let's go through it. How many formations, these are sankharas, are there? There are these three formations, friend, the bodily, verbal, and the mental formation. This is like the fourth kanda. But lady, what is a bodily formation? What is a verbal formation? What is a mental formation? Now this is actually a different meaning of sankhara, sorry, because listen what she says now. In-breathing and out-breathing, friend, are the bodily formation. Applied thought and sustained thought are the verbal formation. Perception and feeling are the mental formation. These are the formations that's used in meditation practice, especially in Anapanasati. But lady, why are in-breathing and out-breathing the bodily formation? Anyone who knows Anapanasati Sutta will know that the fourth of the 18 steps of Anapanasati is calming the bodily sankhara, the bodily function. So this is calming the breath. This is what it means, in-breathing and out-breathing, our bodily. So, but lady, why in-breathing and out-breathing the body formation? Why apply thought and sustained thought, verbal formation? Why perception and feeling, mental formation? Friends, Visakha, in-breathing and out-breathing are bodily. These are states bound up with the body. That is why in-breathing and out-breathing are the bodily formation. So in other words, this is part of the body. The reason I've mentioned, this is not in the suttas, why you use the breath as a meditation object, in-breathing and out-breathing, is because it is a bodily function. It is one bodily function which is profound, which is pronounced enough. You can watch that and everything else disappears. That's what you focus on. But then when it calms down, when it disappears, so with it does all of the body. So it's a stepping stone from one side of the river of body to the other side of the river, which is just pure mind. So you use the breath as a stepping stone in the middle of the river. It's still part of the bodily side, but you use that to leave the body totally behind, like you use a stepping stone in the middle of a river. And what is the next one? The first one applies thoughts and sustains thought, and subsequently one breaks out into speech. Now this is vitakka vichara. Again, it's not real thought, it's a movement of the mind, and you keep that mind moving in that direction, then you break into speech, both inner and outer speech. This vitakka vichara is usually subverbal. And perception and feeling are mental. These are states bound up with the mind. That is why perception and feeling are the mental formation. And if you notice in the eighth stage of Anapanasati, this is where you calm down the citta sankhara, the mental formation, which is you calm down that perception and feeling, especially just the bliss which you have. So the beautiful breath. So you eventually start getting into the mind. Lady, this is attainment of cessation. This is that state of deep meditation after the fourth immaterial jhana. And he's going into the very, very deep states here where everything stops. Lady, how does attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling come to be? So they're talking about just incredible, profound stuff, these two. Friend Visakha, when a monk or meditator is attaining the cessation of perception of feeling, it does not occur to them, I shall attain the cessation of perception of feeling, or I am attaining the cessation of perception of feeling, or I have attained the cessation of perception of feeling. Because this is, you can't do that. This is, your mind is so refined that all such thoughts, all such descriptions are totally not there for you because you're so still. So rather, your mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads you to that state. The simile which I gave for this, I mean, you're really struggling hard to describe these things. The simile I gave to this in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, is imagining like a house with many concentric rooms in it. So, you know, you've got the most inner room, which is the cessation of perception and feeling, and the room which surrounds that is the neither perception or non-perception. The room which surrounds that is nothingness. The room which surrounds that is the unmeasurable consciousness. The room which surrounds that is the unmeasurable space, or miserable space. The room which surrounds that is the fourth jhana, the third jhana, the second jhana, the first jhana. And each of those rooms has got this floor which is incredibly slippy, so much that you cannot get any traction with your feet on it at all. And it's like there's so much grease or some modern material where it's 100% slippy, no friction at all. So how can you get into those innermost rooms? You've got to charge as much as you can on the outside. And once you get into that first room, you can't get any more momentum. It's too slippy. So you charge into that first room. And no matter whatever momentum you have, you've got lots of momentum, you go right through to the very middle. Small momentum, maybe second or third jhana. Just hardly any momentum at all, just go into the first room, and that's as far as you can go. Because within those jhanas, within that realm, you just can't do anything. So it's what you've been doing outside. It really is the momentum of letting go, the momentum of renunciation, the momentum of contentment. And if you have built up a lot of that momentum beforehand, then you go deep into those jhanas, even into the immaterial place. It's what you have previously been developed. What it means there, how much letting go you really have been doing. And that was what leads you into those deeper states. So you have to have so much renunciation, so much letting go. When you get into that first jhana, it just develops very quickly in the second, third, fourth, right into the immaterial states. But you can't say, I'm going to go into these states once you're in one of them. No traction, no will. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's a tough one to explain. That's the only simile you can possibly make, which I've been able to make anyway. Slippery floors. Yeah? You can make a determination, say, determination to go into fourth jhana, but you need sort of the amount of letting go to go to at least there or deeper. So you can't just say, oh, I'm just going to go into first jhana, I'm going to go into fourth jhana. You need this power of letting go, this ability of the mind to totally give up control, abandon, surrender, whatever it is. And the stronger that is, the deeper you go. So if you have a huge amount of ability and strength in letting go, you can say, well, I'm only going to go up as far as third jhana or fourth jhana or something. But usually people don't do that. They just go for broke. Yeah, how long are you going to stay in there? This is actually what comes next. That's okay. Lady, when a bhikkhu... Okay. Actually, when a meditator has attained the cessation of perception and feeling, which state seats in him first? The bodily formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? Friend Visakha, when a meditator has attained the cessation of perception and feeling, they say bhikkhu here, but she's a bhikkhuni, it means just any meditator. The first, the verbal formation ceases. This is the vitaka vichara. This is the movement of the mind. All movement of the mind ceases first. Then the bodily formation, the breath. This actually ceases in the fourth jhana. This is one of those amazing times when if somebody checks you in the fourth jhana or beyond, they can't discern any breath. The breath is not happening at all. That's one of the signs you are in the fourth jhana or beyond. I've always mentioned that story about Ajahn Chah would often stop breathing when he had his stroke. He'd stop breathing for a long period of time, and medics were there checking him all the time. He did that, and that was a sign to us that he was still doing his jhanas. So there he was, unable to speak for about 8 or 9 years, I think. I forget how long now. Unable to speak, you know, having to have food put into his mouth through a tube. But he was having a fine time. And how do we know? Because he would stop breathing for long periods of time. Usually that would kill you. But for him, because it was a jhana, it was perfectly okay. And that time when that nurse... male nurse was there who got very scared that Ajahn Chah might die on his shift and had an argument with the monks looking after him. The monk said, he's okay, he's just in jhanas, leave him alone. And the nurse never believed that. So how can you not breathe? So interestingly, he took blood samples every few minutes from Ajahn Chah while he was not breathing. And, you know, it should have been recorded. Maybe it wasn't under sort of experimental conditions, but he found the blood was well oxygenated all the time, even though he wasn't breathing. So when he found out the blood was well oxygenated, there was no brain damage, nothing would go wrong, so he realized he didn't need to breathe. That's still, obviously still pumping blood, but not using any oxygen, or the oxygen was coming from somewhere, but he wasn't breathing. Interesting. So it can happen. That's right, yeah. They thought he was dead, but no. That's right. Or that man who came here, who went to Charlie Gardner's, in deep meditation, and he wasn't breathing, his brain wasn't working. Came out later on, walked home. Great story. So now you're getting amazing things here, that these things can actually stop. You actually can stop breathing and still be alive. And most medical people think this is crazy stuff, but this is 2,500 years ago and it happens today. And lastly, verbal formation ceases, then a body formation, then a mental formation. Then perception and feeling ceases. This is all perception. So the mind ceases. That's what it's saying. You stop. Lady, how does emergence from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling come to be? Friend Visakha, when a meditator is emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, it does not occur to them, I shall emerge from the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling, or I am emerging from that attainment, or I have emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling, but rather his mind or their mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads him to that state. And that's what Bronwyn was, someone was saying before. What the meditator usually does is they say, I will attain that state for half an hour, 2 hours, whatever. Usually a longer period of time because they've got something to do afterwards. So they just set the alarm clock, as it were. And then at that time, you come out. your alarm clock. Yeah, but anyway, you don't make a determination within that state. You can't. Lady, when a meditator is emerging from this attainment of cessation, perception and feeling, which state arises first in them? The bodily formation, the verbal formation, the mental formation? Should be obvious. Now, as you went in, so you come out, in the backwards order. When a meditator is emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, first the mental formation arises, the perception and feeling. You begin to perceive and feel again. But that sort of grows very slowly from the most subtle of perceptions, with hardly any feeling at all, and then it sort of grows. Perception comes first, feeling comes next. And then the body formation, then the fourth jhana, the body starts to breathe again, then the verbal formation, your mind starts to move again. When someone has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, how many kinds of contact touch them? When we saka, what actually happens to them basically? When a person has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, three kinds of contact touch them. Voidness, signless, and desirelessness. Voidness contact is that based on anatta. You realize nothing there. There's nothing. Total emptiness. Signless is that's when it's based on the perception of anicca. Basically that things are just don't last. There's nothing actually to post a sign. It's like trying to draw. It's a Buddhist symbol. You try to draw a sign on the air, getting a sort of a marker pen and trying to draw. This is air. It's signless. It's just you can't put anything on it. Things are changing so quickly. And lastly, the desireless. That's just to see that this is just only desireless actually leads to this peace. There's basically nothing worth desiring. That's from the understanding of suffering. Lady, when a meditator has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, to what does your mind incline? What does it lean to? What does it tend to? I mean, where does it go next? Not just what does it feel, but what happens next? When someone has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, the mind inclines to seclusion, leans to seclusion, tends to seclusion. Basically, to letting go even more, to being secluded from people and things, being secluded from the body. You just come out of incredible, peaceful, amazing state of letting go. You just want to let go even more. Deep, powerful blood, better move on. How many kinds of feeling are there? This is Vedana. Friend Visakha, there are three kinds of feeling. Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Now this is with every one of the six senses. So usually we use feeling just for that fifth sense of body. That's what we call feeling, pain and pleasure. The feeling in the eye is beauty or ugliness. So actually in English we have a different word for this pleasurable feeling and painful feeling for each one of the six senses. Like joy and sadness, for example, are just pleasurable and painful feelings in the mind. So feeling is nothing to do with emotions. It is that quality of, this is nice, I like this. well, this is ugly, this is awful, which is part of all the five, six senses, and also what's in between, which is just neutral, neither pleasurable nor painful. So, there are three kinds of feeling: pleasant, painful, and neither painful nor pleasant. But, lady, what is pleasant, what is painful, what is neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, whatever is felt bodily or mentally, through any of the six senses, is pleasure, is soothing, is pleasant feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally is painful and hurting, is painful feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally is neither soothing nor hurting, is neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what is the pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? Now, it's interesting here that pleasant feeling, what is pleasant and painful in regard to this? What is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling? What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists and painful when it changes. So even pleasant feeling is painful when it changes. Painful feeling is painful when it persists and pleasant when it changes. That's where I get that thing from. You've heard me say that all pleasure is just a space between two painful feelings. All pain is a pause, so all pain is a pause between two pleasant feelings. Which is, when you understand that, you realize there cannot be a heaven where you have total pleasure, nothing but pleasure, nor can you have a hell which is totally painful, always painful. Even in hell you have a day off. When they turn down the temperature in the ovens, you know, slightly, from 2,000 degrees to 1,999 degrees, it feels much more cool, less pleasant. So all pleasure is actually a change. All pain is a change. It's very powerful. And neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge of it, and painful when there is not knowledge of it. The dullness and the stillness. So those of you meditating, you know, nothing's going on, and it's almost like the pain of boredom or dullness. It's lovely to understand that as a painful feeling. But if you have knowledge of it and understand it, oh, this is beautiful, just being still. Sometimes people they go to a monastery and they just don't know what to do. It's painful for them being there. They can't stand being on a meditation retreat, nothing to do. Yeah, if you understand it, great, nothing to do. That's what I always wanted. Underlying tendencies. What underlying tendency underlies pleasant feeling? What underlies painful feeling? What underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust, to desire, to wanting underlies pleasant feeling. Underlying tendency to aversion underlies painful feeling. Underlying tendency to ignorance underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Does the underlying tendency to lust, desire, underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie all pleasant feeling. Underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Now this is important here, because is all pleasure, all pain, all neither pleasant nor pain? Is that okay? What do you have to do? Do you have to abandon what with regard to these things? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. So you're going to have pleasant feeling, so don't abandon the pleasant feeling. It can't be done. Abandoning the wanting of that pleasant feeling, the lust part of it, abandon that. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. So when things aren't going your way, you get disappointed, you're in pain, there's the sound of the dog barking when you're trying to give a talk. You see, aversion should be abandoned. You don't go around killing the dog. When a neighbor gives you a lot of pain, you don't just go around and complain about them. But the aversion is what you abandon. And lastly, the underlying tendency to delusion or ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So if it's still, know the stillness. Don't try and get rid of the stillness. If you are dull, get to know the dullness. If you are bored, make an investigation into boredom. It's the delusion which should be abandoned, not the dullness. That's why I tell people when they've got sloth and torpor, stop fighting it. Stop trying to get rid of it. Understand it. It's just cause and effect. So I told people on retreat, 3 o'clock in the morning, a young monk in Thailand, I was always dull. No, well, not always, but most days. And I fought it. Now I understand it. Now I've got any ignorance about it. Because I was malnourished, you know, frogs and rice, that's all you had, in a climate I wasn't used to, sleep deprived. No wonder anyone, you know, if the Buddha was English, he'd get sloth and torpor in a position like that. Simply it's cause and effect, that's all. But the Buddha would actually know it. He said, oh, I just haven't slept enough, and I'm malnourished, I'm sick, that's why. So this is how what should be abandoned. Yes? It's an underlying tendency, because this is, you know, just say underlying is a good word. It means that sort of, yeah, you see sort of the pleasure, but what's underneath that? Underneath that, there's a tendency there to want it, or to want it, to want it, to want it. So when you have a pleasant feeling, don't just watch a pleasant feeling. It's just, how are you watching that pleasant feeling? You know, where's this lust or aversion or whatever? What are you doing with it? It is. Sort of, yeah, it's an underline, because sometimes people don't see that. They don't see that it's just creating more problems for themselves. So yeah, it's true. When you finish a retreat, everyone is always happy and smiling at the end of a retreat. You think, why are they doing that? They can't do any more meditation, they've got to go back to work, but I'm going home. And the pleasure which underlines that feeling at the end of a retreat. Have you seen what underlies that pleasure at the end of a retreat? It's just going somewhere else, that's what it is, it's lust. Yeah? Predisposition it can be to, but I like the underlying, it's this is what you see, what's underneath it? Ah, there's lust under there. Oh, it's aversion, so it's something you don't really see unless you dig a bit deeper. And it's only a tendency, it doesn't have to be there, which is one important part. You have pleasant feeling or painful feeling, you don't have to have aversion, you don't have to have the desire to want more of it. Now, does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? Underlying tendency to delusion or ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all, neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling. And the underlying tendency to ignorance does not have to be abandoned in regard to all, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And she explains, here, friend Visakha, quiet secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, a meditator enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by a movement of the mind onto the object and keeping onto the object with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the body. And now that's my translation, as many of you know. So it's the first jhana. With that, the meditator abandons lust. It's a pleasurable feeling, and the underlying tendency to the lust does not underlie that. That's a temporary abandoning of the lust, because the mind's not moving anymore. It can't lust for anything. It can't desire anything. Desire's been abandoned, and there's no underlying tendency to lust in those jhanas or to desire. These are desireless states. So this is the pleasure where there is no unwholesomeness there. Here, a meditator considers us. Oh, when shall I enter upon and abide in that basin the noble ones now enter upon and abide in? When will I become a stream winner? When will I become an arahat? In one who just generates a longing for supreme liberation, grief arises, and that, with that longing as condition. Because you're not enlightened, and that's aversion. There's an underlying tendency there. However, with that, if you can get to these states, you can abandon aversion. An underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. So the Buddha's actually saying here, or Visakha is saying, yeah, you know, that's a painful feeling. You want to become enlightened, but you're not enlightened. He says that, in a sense, has not got the underlying tendency to aversion, because it's a noble aversion. It means, you know, you're going to sort of move in that direction sooner or later. So he said, don't abandon that sort of tendency, that aspiration to one day be a noble one. And here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters, or a meditator enters upon and abides in a fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is a fourth jhana. This is where there's absolutely no pleasure or pain in any of the six senses, really strong equanimity, but fully mindful. So here you're incredibly clear-minded. So this is totally different from being asleep or being unconscious. Totally mindful, but neither pleasure nor pain at all. That part of the mind is gone. So with that, you abandon delusion because you know the mindfulness means you're totally aware of this. It's not an ignorance. It's not like being asleep. And the underlying tendency delusion does not underlie that. So even these, the idea that jhanas will just make you deluded. Here it says there's no delusion in that jhana, and the underlying tendency to it does not exist. So we're getting there, almost finished with this incredibly powerful and deep sutta. Counterparts. What is a counterpart of pleasant feeling? Painful feeling is a counterpart of pleasant feeling. What is a counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling is a counterpart of painful feeling. Again, I mean, we can't have one without the other. They just go together. Like Marks and Spencer's, like, what else have we got? I remember Marks and Spencer's, that's an English company. Sorry? Marks and Sparks, yeah. But anyway, these things, they always go together. what is the counterpart of neither pleasant nor pain, neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Delusion is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, because sometimes, you know, that when you get sort of that delusion, that stillness, sometimes you misunderstand it. It's calling about the dullness here. What is the counterpart of delusion? True knowledge is the counterpart of delusion. What is the counterpart of true knowledge? You know, you really understand things. Deliverance, or vimutti, freedom, is the counterpart of true knowledge. What is the counterpart? Well, you know, what goes with these things? What goes with true knowledge? And then when you see things, you're free. I would mention that in the meditation. It's a very powerful point. Whenever you're meditating, you come across a block. You can't go deeper. So don't keep banging your head against the wall. Don't keep trying. What? There's some delusion there. You're attached to something. You just can't see it. So when you see it, when true knowledge comes about why you're blocked, freedom happens next. And that's such a common experience. When you see, you're meditating, what's happening? What am I attached to? What do I want? What am I expecting? Why am I not content? As soon as you see it, whoosh, you go deeper. You're free from that obstacle. And I often describe it like freeing a dammed drain or something. As soon as you free it, all the water runs away. So that's the freedom, deliverance. What is the counterpart of it? What goes with deliverance, you know, when you're free? Nibbana is a counterpart of deliverance. What is the counterpart of Nibbana? Friend Visakha, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. It is going too far. You were not able to grasp the limit of questions, for the holy life, friend Visakha, merges in Nibbana, culminates in Nibbana, ends in Nibbana. If you wish, friend Visakha, go to the Blessed One, ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so should you remember. Now, it's interesting why sort of Visakha was doing this. And I'm pretty sure if Visakha was a non-returner, he knew the answer. He was just testing out his ex-wife, as husbands are liable to do it from now, time to time. And he knew he was sort of pushing her too far. And she said, come off it. You know, you should know better than that. So the conclusion, then the lay follower Visakha, having delightedly rejoiced in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to her, keeping her on his right, that's respect, he went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, the Buddha, he sat down on one side and told the Blessed One the entire conversation with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. When he finished speaking, the Blessed One told him, the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise, Visakha. The Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in exactly the same way that Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has explained it to it. Such is its meaning, and so should you remember it. So he got the stamp of approval by the boss, by the Buddha. That is what the Blessed One said, and the lay follower Visakha was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And it was stamp of approval. It got its place in the Sutta Pitaka. So there, that's what bhikkhunis were like in the time of the Buddha. And it's an incredibly powerful and deep sutta. That's why sometimes, you know, I wonder, should I read it out? But it doesn't matter. I mean, if you didn't understand all of it, at least you get a taste of it. Sometimes you may have understood a lot more than you expected. But there is the great wisdom of a bhikkhuni. Isn't that wonderful? So, very good. So any questions before we finish off? Amazing, managed to finish it at 4:30. I thought it was going to go until about 6 o'clock. Okay, let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha now.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho saṅkhaṃ namāmi.